Contact session number 12401, Real 2. Although I announced Real 1, this is definitely Real 2.
Colonel Mando, Real 1. You were telling me earlier about the kind of qualities which you felt the security forces needed in the Malayan emergency.
Well, I think that they had to be always on their guard. They could be attacked at any time. And in order to get the better of the communists and to ambush all their rat runs that they used, you had to have patience, endurance, perseverance, and just go on and on and on. And even if you had hundreds of ambushes which produced nothing, you had to go on doing it until finally you did get one which paid off. And in that way, we were able to get the better of the bandits. And in that way, I think our Yorkshire soldiers were absolutely tip-top. They could endure, they could go on and on and on, better than any other people that I've ever met. They were wonderful at it.
You mean they were persistent?
Yes, yes. And it was those qualities of persistence and endurance and never giving up that finally brought home the bacon.
Were there any other regiments in Malaya which had a particularly high reputation which you heard about?
Yes, the Suffolks. When we went there, when I went out there, my battalion didn't seem to be killing any bandits, and it was always the Suffolks were killing bandits. And I was determined that we would be the people who were going to kill the bandits. And I did go and visit other battalions and ask them how they were getting on and that sort of thing. I think the Suffolks were too far away. I wasn't able to visit them. But in the end, I think we were just as good, if not better than the Suffolks. We were very good.
Which battalions did you visit, do you remember?
Well, of course, we were in a Gurkha brigade, and so we had Gurkha battalions, two Gurkha battalions with us. I went to visit the Worcestershire Regiment, and in another a period after our retaining, we went down to Johor, where we were stationed next door to the 15th, 19th Hussars, and the East Yorkshire Regiment was down there. But I did go and visit the Worcesters, I remember.
Do you think that they were free with advice, or do you think that there were any trade secrets?
I don't think they were any better than we were at the time. We were two seers, both of us wanting to do a little bit better. And I don't think they ever did achieve quite the same, fame that we did. We did very well indeed. And if you read our book, you'll see that Field Marshal Templar in the foreword speaks very highly of the battalion and what it did in Malaya.
What did you feel was the ideal size of unit to go out on ambushes and guerrilla hunting?
The ideal?
Size of unit.
The smaller the better. Three men was probably the best. And five or seven was about all you could safely deploy, shooting at crosswise and that sort of thing. And if you had 20 ambushes of 3 to 7 men, that was far better than having the whole company going in on one expedition to one place. You'd have much more chance of success. And you would spread your influence over a far greater area, and the impact of your operations on the civilian population would be that much greater.
Were you satisfied with the equipment which you had in the jungle?
I would have liked to have many more automatic weapons. I think the ideal weapon was some sort of automatic shotgun, because the range you fired at was never more than about 30 yards in the jungle. So you wanted a short range, possibly automatic weapon, which would just something like a Tommy gun, which would blast people apart at short range. You didn't need to shoot at 300 yards or anything like that. I thought the tents were quite appalling, that we were forced to live in tents. The tent itself wouldn't last more than 6 months in the tropical sun, and we ought to have been allowed to build bashers. Three-quarters of our equipment I handed in because we didn't need it. Things like cooking equipment and things like that. What you needed was something or another to enable chaps to go out and spend perhaps 10 days in the jungle, a small party, completely independent, able to cook and look after themselves with automatic weapons. And we weren't badly equipped, no.
So you preferred automatic weapons to the rifle?
Yes, yes. The carbine was ideal. If we could have had more carbines, I would have been very happy. They're an automatic rifle.
Why couldn't you have had more?
They weren't issued. We only had about one the whole battalion. I think they were American. M3s, I think they were called. We had very, very few of them. I don't think they were an issue. They'd been won by somebody or another.
Did General Templar come and visit you personally? Yes. Did you meet him?
Yes, I did, yes.
What impression did he make?
I think he was absolutely super. He sat on a table, swinging his legs, I remember, and he talked to the chaps, and he told them why they were out there and what they were doing and what was expected of them, and how important it was that their task should be well carried out. And I think General Harding gave us the same. He was absolutely first class too, and he came to visit the battalion. You know, because people would say, well, what the hell am I doing in the jungle? Why am I here? What good am I doing? You know, let the blighters have Malaya, you know. Does it matter to me, my home in Middlesbrough? What effect will it have on me if these communists kill off a few more people? So they needed to be told that this was a very important job, and I think Templar made us all realize that. And, of course, he made the Malays and the Chinese realize it too. Because in Malaya, we were waging the war on behalf of the Malays and on behalf of the Chinese. And until Templar arrived, there was no real tremendous effort made to get the Malays into the battle and feel it was their war, and the Chinese to feel it was their war, and it was their job to help. And he did that extremely well, I think.
So was there a problem to motivate the men?
Ours? Well, as I say, when we started to be successful, and we were the chaps who were killing all the bandits, and it wasn't just the Suffolks, they got frightfully keen. They were enormously keen. But until they did have some success, I think they were lacking in motivation, as you call it.
But did you ever hear any of your battalions say, what on earth are we doing out here so far from home?
No. One took very great care to let them know what they were doing and why. And so if one had talked to national servicemen and said to them, now, whatever your job is in civilian life, Don't just think of this as a waste of time. Whatever you do here, if you do well in the army, your character and your performance back home will improve. You will have done something for your country. If we fail in this, you know, we shall fail. And I made that point to them very much, so that I remember giving one lecture to the troops, and two of them came up to ask me about it, about what I meant. And I said, well, what do you do in civilian life? And the first one said, well, I make 18-inch guns. And I said to the other fellow, what do you do? He said, I make glass eyes. And how is it that our job out abroad here will improve my performance as an 18-inch gun maker? And I pointed out that he could become a leader and not just a follower, and he would have had experience which other chaps back in Middlesbrough, whatever it was, hadn't had. And if that didn't do him some good and get him on ahead, I would be very, very surprised, so long as he took his opportunities and did his stuff out here in the army. So we did make that point, particularly with the national servicemen.
How did the national servicemen and the regulars compare with each other in their performance in Malaya? Was there much difference?
We had some first-class regulars, and we had some first-class national service chaps. The only problem was when you got a jolly good young national service man, when he was absolutely at the top of his form and ready to take on anybody, he would go home. So that the regulars always had the edge on them, but I had some first-class chaps from both sides of the coin.
To what rank could the national serviceman rise? To sergeant?
Oh, yes. And we had officers too, national service officers. They would naturally not get up to above a lieutenant or a platoon commander rank. The national serviceman, I suppose, would be unlikely to reach the rank of sergeant, unless there was a particular vacancy for him and he was absolutely the man for it. So I should say Corporal Lance Corporal would be about his top level.
Did they really all come from Yorkshire, or did they come from a much wider spread?
Pretty well all from Yorkshire, I think. Pretty well all, yes. Some of the regulars may have come from other parts of the world. In the old days, we used to get London squads and Birmingham squads if there weren't enough recruits coming down from Yorkshire, and some of those may have remained on, and a very good leavening of Yorkshire solidity they were too, to have a little bit of Cockney and Birmingham liveliness, and they made a very good mixture, I thought.
So the Yorkshiremen were more solid than...
Very solid indeed, yes, I thought. Wonderful infantry. Just the sort of chaps you want when all hell breaks loose and things are flying through the air at very high speed all around you and things look very awful. The Yorkshireman, he's still there. He won't run away and leave you. They're wonderful. Just the chaps.
What was the relationship of your men with the local population?
They didn't have an awful lot to do with them, I don't think. We wanted to impress the local population with the fact that we were on their side. We were protecting them. We were their friends and not the communists. And I think we did succeed in doing that. We did succeed in protecting them from the communists and killing the communists. And they get, as they got to know us a bit, they appreciated that. If you sent the whole damn company into the jungle, there was nobody there all around the village moving about and ambushing and making sure the bandits didn't come in them an evening to help themselves to food and that sort of thing. So we got to know them a great deal better than we did before. and I think our relationship was very good with them.
Did any of your soldiers misbehave towards the local population?
I don't remember much crime. One chap, I do remember, wouldn't go into the jungle. And he would hit a corporal, something like that, just before he was due to go into the jungle. But I found out that his complaint was that he was a physical training expert and set great store by his physical perfections and that sort of thing. He wanted to exercise and things. And in the jungle, lying up in a wet ambush position for a week didn't suit his book at all. And so he'd up and strike a corporal and be sent off to the glass house where he could do as much exercise as he liked, and if he tried to keep out of the jungle for that reason. So what I did was I just gave him 28 days pay, and so he went into the jungle without any pay, just the same, and he never went to the glass house at all. In that respect, while we were on active service, you were able to give punishment loss of pay. And so people realized that if they did misbehave, they just lost their pay and went on going to the jungle just the same. So that was quite effective. I don't think we had much trouble with the locals at all. When we went down to Singapore for retraining, we were pitchforked straight into the Maria Hertog riots. Well, I'd had a lot of experience with riots in India and that sort of thing, and so I was quite confident we'd deal with the riots in Singapore. And of course my chaps were absolutely first class with the local Chinese and that sort of thing, and if there'd be some old woman had a wheelbarrow full of apples upset or anything like that, my corporal and two or three chaps who were down there would come along and pick up all her apples for her and put her right and help her, and they had the meeting out of their hands in no time at all. But they were very good, I think.
What do you personally remember of dealing with the Maria Hertog riots?
Well, my driver and car were ambushed and absolutely treed, and spent about 3 days in a police station. I didn't know where the hell he was. My wife was very nearly murdered. She drove right through the worst of the rioting area. I never knew there was a riot going on. Went and did some Christmas shopping in Juchat. Fortunately, we had a car with a very low roof, and they couldn't see who was in it, I think. But I was flown down and distributed the battalion around, and I was quite confident that we'd soon have it sorted out, because I did know about riots and that sort of thing. I thought I was quite good at that. Whereas I didn't know anything about jungle warfare, and I went to Malaya. I did know about riots from India, so I felt on very safe ground.
How exactly did you put your India experience into practice in the riots in Singapore?
Well, first of all, don't deploy masses of troops. Use them again in small packets and spread them out well, so that the pool of oil here spreads out gradually and you get your pools of oil all spread out and calm a whole area. Make them realize that you are there to look after them, to see that they aren't murdered and killed and that sort of thing.
See who aren't murdered?
The people you are dealing with. If you're sent into an area where the Malays are killing the Chinese or something like that, you protect the Chinese from the Malays, and you quieten down the Malays and tell them not to be naughty boys, and you make the whites obey their curfew orders and point out to them that this has got to be done, and so on, and just assert all your authority and the rule of law and whatever the authorities say has to be done, you just make sure it is done.
But the Malays weren't killing the Chinese and the Maria Hertog riots.
Well, it was the Malays who were upset by Maria Hertog. She was a Christian girl who had been brought up in a Malay family, and when her parents or her guardians wanted to get her home and make her into a Christian again, the Malays thought this was sacrilege, and they were the people who were upset, not the Chinese. And they were the ones who were rioting. And of course, when a Malay does get upset, he can be a very dangerous chap. You know the word amok. And if you get an amok, he's a very dangerous man. So if the Malay started running amok, you have to watch out.
Did you see that in those riots?
I didn't myself, but I did think that we might use amoks against the communists, the bandits. Why not have an amok with you? And if he was amok, send him off after the communists, and he would never stop until he'd killed them all, or got killed himself.
Did you do that?
No, we didn't do that thing. The trouble was, he might kill you or anybody. He was like a mad dog, and you couldn't direct his attention to say, that's a bad man, you kill him, but we're good men, don't kill us.
How long were you operating in Singapore against the Maria Hertog riots?
Oh, it's all over in 3 or 4 days. Only 3 or 4 days.
Was it Friday?
My driver was treed in a police station for 3 days, and in 5 days I would say it was all over.
Your driver was?
My driver drove my car. I was flown down, and my driver was driving it. We were coming out on retraining. The whole battalion was coming down, company by company, from the jungle, their various jungle bases, and my wife came down, and I was flown down and told to hurry up and get the battalion down to Singapore and sort out this riot situation. We were just handy coming out at the time, so they said, well, the Green Hearts can do it.
Do you mean your driver was trapped in a police station?
My driver was driving my car, full of my kit, down the main road into Singapore and heading down to our Singapore base at Selarang. And on his way there, they tried to upset his car, tip it over, and he managed to escape from that and went to a police station where he spent the next 3 days locked up in the police station because of the rioting going on outside. He couldn't get out, and I didn't know where he was. The car was virtually undamaged, and he got out again in the end and rejoined me in Selarang. But he had a very narrow escape.
Did he seem to be shaken by it?
Well, I think he was all right by the time he got back, but I think he was a bit shattered at the time. Must have been a very unpleasant situation.
How frightening was it for you in the riots?
Frightening? Well, I was quite confident about it. I had a very rough journey down in a very bad storm in a light aircraft, and rushed to GHQ, where some very alarming stories were being spread around about what was happening and what could happen. But I thought our chaps would sort it all out pretty well, and we did, and I was quite confident about it.
What kind of stories were these?
Well, they were worried that the Malays, Muslims, would get inflamed and there'd be some kind of jihad about this Maria Hertog girl. And I think they had published a picture of her at an altar with a candle. And a candle at an altar is something terrible for a Muslim. And it upset them, something upset them very much indeed. And the Malays, fortunately, there were not an awful lot of them in Singapore. They're mostly Chinese and a lot of Indians, too. But the Malay people there were very, very, very angry and misbehaving very badly. And I think the authorities were rather, because all the troops were up in the jungle, they hadn't got many troops down there, and they were a bit worried about things. Of course, half the police were Malays, and, you know, would they react properly, and nobody knew what to do or anything else. But so the arrival of my battalion was absolutely a gift of the gods, and when we arrived, I think we sorted it out pretty quickly.
Did you have any problems with Malay police in the riots?
No, I don't think so. I think the local police probably made sure that the Malay police were quietened down, and the Chinese and the Indians took the main brunt of the rioting. And one wouldn't obviously send a Malay policeman into the middle of a Malay rioting, not a Malay. So I think they handled that quite tactfully and diplomatically.
What was the attitude of the Chinese and Indian communities to the riots?
Well, I think they were a bit alarmed, really, because a lot of damage was being done. Shops were being bashed in and set on fire and that sort of thing. Roads were being blocked, and people were rioting about and doing a lot of damage. And, of course, it didn't matter what they were damaging. They just wanted to damage something and let their feelings loose. And we went in and tried to stop it, and we did. And if there some damage had occurred, our chaps would try and help repair it and that sort of thing, pick up the old woman's wheelbarrow, say, full of apples and that sort of thing. And we didn't have much trouble with that.
Did your troops open fire in the riots?
No.
Were any of them casualties?
No casualties, no fire, I don't think. I don't think they opened fire, even over the heads. No, I don't think so.
Do you remember any particular roads in Singapore where the riots took place?
I don't know the name of it, but there was one road not very far from GHQ where we had quite a lot of trouble. A lot of damage had been done, and there were a lot of white people living there, British and various other foreigners, Australians perhaps, and people like that, who were pretty alarmed that they were going to be set on fire or murdered or something like that. I can't remember the name of it, but I know where it is. I think I could take you there if I went to Singapore. That was about the worst area, and of course it was not very far from GHQ and, you know, rather nerve centre of things, so it was rather alarming. It was an area where one wouldn't have thought that there'd be a lot of trouble, because there were so many houses with white people in them, English and so on. One wouldn't have thought that the Malays would have their hatred and their feelings would have erupted in quite that way in that particular area. But that was the worst, I think.